Okay, so I think we're going to start. We're going to switch the order a little bit because the person who was our first speaker hasn't got here yet, but we don't want to run too late. So I'd like to welcome our first speakers, Kat and Jack, who are going to speak about the abridged Homosaurus. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jack van der Wel. I'm head of collections and cataloging at ILIA LGBT Heritage in Amsterdam. I will give a presentation about the Homosaurus together with Kat Walker, who's standing next to me. Kat will introduce himself when he comes forward. I'm going to tell you something about the background and the history of the Homosaurus. At the end, we will present you the website of the Homosaurus, and you can see the work, what we've been doing. And Kat will be talking about the work of the editorial board of the Homosaurus. The Homosaurus started in 1997 as a Dutch and English gay and lesbian thesaurus by ILIA LGBT Heritage for their collections. Over time, more terms relating to bisexuality, trans, gender and intersex concepts were added, but not methodologically. Also, other issues were completely outdated or missing. One of the problems with the original Homosaurus was its rather flat structure. Due to the lack of connections, descriptors were isolated from one another and therefore easily missed. Therefore, a major revision of the Homosaurus was necessary, and with the help of Alan Greenblatt, the original Homosaurus was transformed into a more inclusive and hierarchical thesaurus for LGBTQ archives, libraries and documentation centers throughout the world. The results were presented at the 2011, 12 and 16 LGBTQ ALMS conferences. The major objective of the Homosaurus was and is to provide LGBTQ archives, libraries and documentation centers with a ready-to-use international thesaurus of LGBTQ index terms. The absence of such an index was seen as the principal reason for the lack of indexing of gay and lesbian materials and information about LGBTQ life and existence. Standard indexing and classification systems did and do not offer a sufficiently detailed and up-to-date vocabulary to retrieve the wealth of resources available. Existing classifications frequently don't include information of special concerns to LGBTQ persons. In 2016, I was contacted by K.G. Rawson. He's the director of the Digital Transgender Archives, the DTA in the USA, to transform the Homosaurus into an online linked vocabulary, which would enable other online repositories to use this resource. Linked data is about using the web to connect related data that were not previously linked. Using the linked data version of the Homosaurus will allow library and archiving websites to describe their materials with one vocabulary. It can connect LGBTQ archives all over the world using the same vocabulary. This means using the Homosaurus as a common language. You can see here some of the original version of the Homosaurus vocabulary made by the DTA in the USA. Another proposal of K.G. Rawson was to set up an editorial board to improve the vocabulary because it was still too flat and not inclusive enough. At the 2016 LGBTQ ALMS conference in London, I met Kat Walker, who presented the paper Overcoming the Barriers, Improving Access to LGBTQ Content in Collections. I asked him to join the editorial board along with several others. The editorial board now consists of 6 members: K.G. Rawson, Kat Walker, Amber Bailey, Marika Sifor, Chloe Noland, all from the USA, and myself. The editorial board started its work in August 2016, and the revision was ready in May 2019, so very recently. Kat will now talk more about the work of the editorial board.
Hi, I'm Kat Walker from Los Angeles, California, from Loyola Marymount University. I'm also the director, one of the directors at large on the GLBTRT of the American Library Association, and a longtime volunteer of One Archives in Los Angeles. Our first meeting was on August 16th, 2016, with 6 of the 7 original members present online via Skype. Jack from the Netherlands and Orla Egan from Ireland joined Amber Bailey, Marika Sifor, K.J. Rawson, and myself from the United States. Dee Michelle, another American, was unable to attend that meeting. At that meeting, Jack gave us a similar introduction to the one you just heard. We decided that we should create an abridged version that would be only LGBTQI terms, as there are many non-LGBTQI terms in the original Homosaurus. This would have more possible terms for use in indexing LGBTQI resources than general thesauri, such as the Library of Congress subject headings, also known as LCSH, and could be used as a supplemental thesaurus in libraries, archives, and digital collections. We spent some time discussing how the Homosaurus is currently used, which is mostly by IHLIA and the Digital Transgender Archive, and how people identify themselves, which can be different from how they were identified at birth and/or how they present themselves in appearance, as well as how open they are about their sexual orientation and gender identity. We divided up a spreadsheet containing all the Homosaurus terms amongst the 7 board members and began figuring out which terms were LGBTQI specific and should be kept, which should be discarded, and which ones needed discussion first. We met every 1 to 2 months to review our revisions and to discuss what types of terms we should try to keep as LGBTQI related. For example, we tried to keep terms for sexual activities, but not for body parts, and to keep feminism terms. We decided to keep LGBTQI-related LCSH terms in the abridged Homosaurus, since they often link to non-LCSH terms in the Homosaurus hierarchies, and would be expected to be included. In summer 2017, we started reviewing groups of terms that were related and which we were uncertain about. These groups included religion and ethnicity, drugs, sexually transmitted diseases, sexual practices, identity terms, and relationships and family. We decided to cut broad religion and ethnicity terms, but to keep specific LGBTQ-related terms, such as two-spirit people. And here's an example from the online vocabulary that I just pasted. We also added many transgender-related terms from the Digital Transgender Archives list of global terms. Here's some examples. There's a brother boy, which is an indigenous Australian term for people who transition from female to male. Femmini yellow. In Italy, a Neapolitan term for homosexual males with a feminine gender expression, often considered a third gender, associated with good luck. Mahu, which is a term used in Hawaiian and Tahitian cultures for third gender persons who blend genders and often hold spiritual roles. And pangender people, or people who identify as multiple or all genders. For drugs, we decided to add terms for those that are often used in the LGBTQ community, but not covered in LCSH, such as poppers. We tried to follow a similar approach to STD terms and sexual practices, with slang terms occasionally included. On this slide, you can see under drugs, we have things like party drugs, such as crystal meth, MDMA, poppers. Sexual practices include terms such as anonymous sex, clitoral sex, cottaging, erotic massage, getting laid, nipple play, rubber sex, tantric sex, water sports. We discussed whether gay should be used as an umbrella term, as in LCSH, or only used to mean gay male. We decided to use LGBTQ as our umbrella term instead of gay or queer. Whenever we wanted to have separate sexual orientation or gender orientation terms for a concept, we used concept parentheses LGBTQ as the broader, the BT term, with narrower terms or NTs for bisexual concept, gay concept, lesbian concept, queer concept, and or transgender concept. For example, under the broader term families, parentheses, LGBTQ, there are narrower terms for bisexual families, gay families, lesbian families, queer families, single-parent families, and transgender families. And under bars, parentheses, LGBTQ, we have bisexual bars, drag bars, gay bars, lesbian bars, and transgender bars. Some concepts that did not seem to need breaking out to narrower bisexual, gay, lesbian, queer, and transgender terms have LGBTQ in front to distinguish from non-LGBTQ aspects of the term. LGBTQ is generally used for people when possible, such as LGBTQ prisoners instead of LGBTQ prisons. As time went on, we finished deleting non-LGBTQ terms and started adding new LGBTQ-related terms. Earlier, we often discussed term changes amongst the group first, but eventually we began making the changes and discussing them afterwards, or creating separate documents with proposed terms and then discussing those. A lot of additions and changes were made to transgender-related terms, and many of these were contributed by college students working with KJ in the Digital Transgender Archive, also known as DTA. Such as on this slide, you can see some of the new terms we added: gender identity, gender markers, trans marches, transmasculine people, transitioning status, activism, LGBTQ, consent, gender expression, LGBTQ friendliness, transgender survivors of hate crimes, sexual climax. Last summer, we distinguished between sex, parentheses, body, and sex, parentheses, act. We also discussed where fucking went, which was between the broader term sex, parentheses, act, and the narrower term ass fucking. And you can see here some of the narrower terms we have under sex, parentheses, body, and sex, parentheses, act. So you can get the idea of the separate concepts. KJ added scope notes to some of the culturally specific gender identities and added more trans-related terms. Jack worked on LGBTQ historical terms, and Marika added family, kinship, and social media terms. I reconciled many hierarchies so that broader, narrower, and related terms and cross-references appeared in all the corresponding places. Dee decided to leave the board after missing several meetings, and eventually Orla did as well, decreasing the group to 5 members by 2018. Billy's wife, Lydia Willoughby, joined the editorial board for a few months in 2018 and helped Billy create a queer sex ontology. And we welcome Chloe Noland, also from Los Angeles, to our group in September. In October 2018, the editorial board set a goal of finishing our revisions by the end of the calendar year and then transforming it into an online version by early 2019. During the next few months, we continued to revise some terms, such as pride celebrations, prejudice and discrimination, masculinity, sexual consent, butch and femme identity, circumcision, and privilege. Chloe, our newest member, contributed legal terms and helped us with several other subject areas. We also dealt with some remaining questions, such as sexual orientation versus sexual preference, rape and victims of rape, public bathrooms as a site of anti-transgender discrimination and phobia, acronyms, discrimination and phobias. By January 2019, we finished reviewing several separate documents of terms, such as the queer sex ontology, family terms, personal and family law, and identity terms, and incorporated them into the abridged Homosaurus. Billy exported the Google Doc into an Excel spreadsheet so that developer Steven Anderson can transfer it into the linked data online form. We took a break from meeting for a while and then resumed meeting quarterly to discuss new terms in general editing and how we want the website to be set up. On May 1st, 2019, our work became available as a linked data vocabulary online at http://homosaurus.org/v2. We met on May 9th to start planning our future steps, which include publicizing and increasing the usage of the Homosaurus. Jack and I are speaking here, and all six editorial board members are planning to start writing three articles about the Homosaurus for potential publication during the coming year. Jack has already presented to LGBTQ libraries and archives from Germany, Austria, and Switzerland at queer search meetings November 2017 and November 2018. The Homosaurus has been approved to use as a thesaurus source for subject headings in MARC records, with the code being HOMOIT. We also decided to create some publicity materials and to add two interested people as new members this fall. We were hoping to have some cards available here with our logo on them to pass out, but unfortunately, they're not quite ready yet. We will meet again in July to continue to plan our next steps and to revise and maintain the linked data vocabulary. It will be easier to update in its database form, and we plan to set up a page on the website for submissions of new terms and for suggestions of further revisions. The Homosaurus is meant to evolve as vocabulary usage in this area keeps changing. Many terms and identities have just recently come into general use, and we expect this pattern to continue. We are also looking for more editorial board members and hope that our group becomes more international and diverse. We can try to answer any questions that you may have at the end of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack and Kat. Welcome to everybody who's come in. I know transport's not been great this morning. I'm Pierrette Squires, your chair. Can I just check, do we have Tuan in here yet? No, okay. So we've shifted the order a little bit of our presentations, because I think one of our presenters has also got stuck with the travel. So we will take questions at the end of the panel. So can I welcome to the stage Amy Levine?
I want to apologize to you for my phone. It's a new phone, and it never occurred to me that junk calls from Berlin would find it, and within the first week. So I'm sending something out that is only semi-related to my talk. So my goals today are to provide information on current trends in book publishing related to museums and gender. And I wish to do this because I think it's critical to getting out information about our field. And after talking about some of this information, I'd like to discuss how these trends affect gender activism in institutions, and to focus on which current publisher strategies best promote gender activism and which suppress it. So I'm going to begin by talking about some of the general issues and background, some of the information I learned, questions and implications for the future. And I do want to say this was quite an informal study. It was limited because I knew I would only have a few minutes to talk to you, but I do hope to extend it. So let me start with some background. Book publishing related to museums and gender has flourished, but with the exception of catalogs related to particular exhibits or shows, it's really been quite a recent phenomenon. In 1995, the Smithsonian Press published a book focusing on women in museums. It was based on a conference, and it was some of the papers. They're very diverse. Some are very short. Some are very long. And then the next round came after 2000, with my collection, Gender, Sexuality, and Museums, coming in 2010. There were articles and journals, lots of articles in the meantime, I should say, lots and lots, which helped me with my book because I could ask some of them to be reprinted. But I should say a sign of the lack of books in this area is that when I first proposed my book for the first time in my life, all my other books had been pleased to the publishers and it was noblesse oblige, right? Well, maybe we'll publish you. They were actually competing at the conference I brought my proposal, and one would come up to me and say, what did you just talk to them about? Are you going with them? And then another publisher came to me and said, well, come talk to us about your proposal. This has never happened to me. So it suggested to me that there was a hunger for works in the field. And of course, they got stuck with my book. So I think another force that has led to the burgeoning of books has been the growth of museum studies grad programs, and especially the Lester doctoral program. And this worked two ways. On the one hand, it led to a need for research, because students needed to know what was happening for their own research. But it also led to the creation of research titles as students and faculty presented materials. Of course, associations such as ICOM and the AAM in the US, the Museums Association in the UK, and parallel groups in the Netherlands and elsewhere have also promoted publications. There's two on. As they have embraced diversity. And I want to say, because this is sort of a recurrent theme here, is that English has dominated these works regardless of where they've appeared. And this brings me to Nancy Fuller, who was formerly at the Smithsonian. She gave a presentation like this about, I think it was almost 10 years ago. And so I talked to her about what she said in her presentation and how things have changed. And one of the things she brought to my attention that was sort of at the back of my mind is that, of course, the proliferation of English is a mixed blessing. While enabling people from various cultures to communicate, it also contributes to the homogenization of museological ideas and practices as terms and language get conflated into one. And that's actually, I may want to ask you about that later. So that's both a good thing and a bad thing. So here were my sources as I kind of looked at these questions. I talked to Roman and Littlefield. I talked to an editor there. They're a U.S. press. They tend to publish medium-length books, what I consider mid-price range. They're fairly practical guides. Then, of course, there's Museum Etc. based in the U.K. and U.S., which tends to do very long, expensive collections. And then Routledge, which I think in some ways dominates internationally, originally based in Oxford, is now moving to shorter books that can be published quickly and less expensively, although they have plenty of big and very expensive books out there. I didn't have a chance to talk to Berghahn and some of the other more general publishers. And then I talked to some authors who worked with these people and series editors, drawing on my own experiences with two of the presses. Jenna Ashton, who's editor of Feminism in Museums, which was published in 2017 and 18 by museums, etc. Susan Ferrantinos, who authored Interpreting LGBT History at Museums and Historic Sites for Roman and Littlefield. Kylie Message, who's an author and editor, the series editor for Museums in Focus from Routledge, which is one of their series, which is primarily intended to be very short. And then Nikki Sullivan, who has a from Australia, is a forthcoming Routledge book called Queering the Museum, co-edited with Craig Middleton. And these were the questions for the presses. The list of books that you publish indicate that you're committed to publishing on diversity in general. Why? Do the books sell well? Secondly, books that I've read from your press, I'm narrowing focus on gender and diversity. What do you see as the benefits of this strategy? And how does it connect to your willingness to publish on these topics? And then I got into kind of nitty-gritty process questions of how do they select manuscripts? What's the review process? What kind of editing? And this seemed important in terms of language, too, especially if you were a non-native speaker of English. Do these reflect your willingness to publish about equity and diversity? And then, of course, the general, you know, is there anything else I should know question. Can you read this comparatively? I have individual slides, but I think it's more interesting to look across as well as down. So Routledge, well, all three of them said books on diversity sell well, and it's a growing international market. So, you know, lest you thought otherwise, I'm sure you didn't, certainly market forces are important here. But for Routledge, they said that one of the things for them is they really want to be perceived as cutting edge and as ethical. They do commission some books, and I know they've come to me and said, what topics do you think we should be publishing on, and gone to find people. They use expert reviews for proposals and manuscripts. And they do work with some professional organizations, and those organizations sometimes have their own review questions related to diversity and equity. As you probably know, their content can be quite theoretical. My impression, at least with, I'm going into my third book with them, that's the flyer that's been coming around, is that they're very rigorous at the copy editing and proofreading stage. And what I am noticing is part of the reason that they wanted to go to shorter books besides cost was they wanted to be able to get things out quickly before the ideas were dated. But I have to say they seem to be getting slower rather than faster. Not to speak badly, but I turned in this book manuscript in mid-February. I have yet to see the copy edited pages, okay? So that's in with my previous manuscript, it was one month turnaround for everything. So this is much slower. And if you were to be looking to publish in a hurry, I would really ask about that. Museums, et cetera, they said that the books, the editors said that books sell as well as any others, but that the theme of diversity does not guarantee good sales. So they were a little more guarded about this. But they did also claim a progressive social agenda. But again, they were kind of like, these are just two of the issues that we're happy to cover. It was less of a directed focus. And then they took a very different approach to editing. We rarely indulge in peer review and are uninterested in the game of academics publishing, primarily to get promotion. And the content is therefore mixed. You have practical and theoretical. If you look at feminisms in museums, you can really see that. They say they like to edit with a light touch. Now, the downside for them, and I've tried to include a downside for each press, is that there do seem to be errors in production. So for instance, if you look at Feminisms and Museums, the two volumes together are 1,244 pages. I know because I reviewed the book, so I had to read every one of them. There's no index, so unless you're using it electronically, it's very hard to use it for research. Different chapters use different reference methodologies. One chapter has the wrong chapter headers, so again, if you were browsing through, you wouldn't necessarily find what that chapter was. So you get the light editing touch is a mixed thing, okay? And then Roman came right out and said, look, books on diversity sell well, but they also were very direct that libraries in this day and age are one of their major sources of sales because who else can afford these books? And they said that libraries are a big market and very committed. Their selection process also tends to be a review of the proposal and manuscript. They work with a lot of associations. Oops, that quote was supposed to be under Rutledge. It slid over. Rutledge likes to claim themselves as the leading academic publisher. So back to Roman. Practical slant. Books are often presented more as a handbook. Editing, they tend to combine copy editing and the proofs, so you lose a stage, but it moves it faster. However, several of the authors have said they take forever to pay royalties. This wasn't just, and mind you, not that if you've published a book, you know if you get $25, you're lucky. So, you know. So these are the questions I had for the editors and authors. Tell me about the process you used in editing the book, starting with how and where and when you solicited articles, if it was a collection, how you made the selections and established your topic, what kinds of editing work did you do, and then again, the anything else question. And again, is this too small? No? Okay. So Ashton's book, which is an edited collection, this is the Feminisms in Museum, the 1,244 pages. She said she had originally planned on only one volume, but that there was so much she wanted to include. And she said, this was my first editing job, so I approached it as a curator. In my mind, I was curating a potential show. So she said she spent most of her time editing on pieces by non-native speakers to help them achieve parity with the other works. Now, of course, there's always a question then of, what happens to content? The price, as she said, she was a little irritated. She said a lot of people have complained about the price, but it's a spit in the ocean compared to artworks, and yet artists are telling me this was way too much to pay for two books. And she did refer to her feminism and activist ambitions as part of her rationale for publishing the book. Susan Ferrantinos' book is a monograph. She's a contractor and researcher. She's worked a lot with the National Park Service in the U.S., and she was really interested in the sort of manual how-to guide aspect of what she did, and said she was surprised by how often her book was used as a textbook. She's not an academic author, and this was really an interesting quotation. I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. I don't need to write books for tenure promotion, lucky her, lucky woman, so I don't need to demonstrate my ability to move the thinking of the field forward. And that kind of logical shift might be something else we want to talk about, but she does think she wanted to offer and thinks her book offers a diverse representation of LGBT experiences and challenge the governing ideas of what counts as LGBTQ and as historically significant. And she said in thinking about what to talk about, she really wanted the values to guide the process. Nikki Sullivan said, on the other hand, that she found very little that brings theory and practice together in a substantial and sustained way, that many of the books she saw were one or the other. And so they chose not to undertake case studies, but to talk about examples as necessary. And this is a big question, because I've heard the criticism that sometimes these books are just show and tell. Here's this wonderful thing that this museum is doing or this institution is doing, but it, again, does it bring the field forward? Is it thinking about whys and hows? So again, it's something else we can talk about. Thank you. She said she edited to make it accessible beyond an academic audience, and for us, it's about activism. So I'm closing. The closing questions, and I have some tentative conclusions based on this, and I think many of them are arguable, so I hope we'll have a good discussion. The first question is, which is more, and I hate this word democratic, maybe I should say it shows more equity, a longer and more expensive work like this Feminisms in Museums, where you can include 1,244 pages of people, but there might be some sacrifices in quality, and it's very expensive. Or a shorter book that's much more selective, more carefully edited, and less expensive. In my mind, I thought I would come out for the longer works, but as I concluded this study, I actually found myself leaning towards the shorter ones, and feeling that anything that can drive book prices down is to be encouraged. To what extent are market forces responsible for the books in our field? How much is really activism, and what gaps result because of it? I do think that sales drive a great deal, although there are ethical concerns, but I think this offers a partial explanation for the continuing marginalization of works on transgender and non-binary identities, that the publishers aren't seeing the sales there yet, and so those fields are still kind of not as much published, although I think it's coming. Like, my new book has a lot more on transgender and non-binary identities, and they were happy to see that. The reviewers saw that as a positive about the manuscript. How heavily should books be edited? How does editing affect the works by non-English speakers or activists with little publishing experience? And this is a mixed bag. I think rigorous editing can help people who are non-native speakers come into print and be understood and have their works more widespread. But as I said, I think there's also that flattening effect. It can also, though, I think, help people who are not used to publishing. And that, I don't think, is necessarily a negative. We want to get as many different people in print as possible. I do think that theory should be accessible and linked to activism and practical ends. And then my final question, how important are academic forces in generating publishing related to inclusion, and specifically to gender and sexuality? And this has been a debate. A lot of the museum people I work with kind of sneer at academics like me, and I know this. And they say, you know, we don't really know and understand museums. And then I always say, well, yeah, actually, I have worked in museums. It just, I admit, hasn't been that recent because I can't be in two places at once, right? But actually, at the beginning of my career, I was in an education department and a museum and plenty busy. And what I would like to point out is that in many societies, not all of them, academic scholars have been able to publish progressive work before people at public museums and heritage sites, because we do not have to answer to boards and donors and municipalities and so forth. And so even if we may appear scarily theoretical and some of our writing may appear as gibberish, and it appears as gibberish to me too, I'll be the first to acknowledge it, I think that we have provided rationales for places like museums and these public institutions that answer to the boards and the donors to bring their work forward. So I don't see this really as a bad thing, but as kind of an interdependence in the best way. And that, you know, an example I would give is that my co-editor, Josh Adair, he wrote an article in my first gender collection about historic houses that had belonged to people who identified as LGBT or Q. And he has had emails from staff at several historic houses saying, we were able to use your article to move our board forward and to do more activism at our institution. So I close with these questions and my tentative answers. They're only tentative. Thank you for hearing me out. If you have questions or comments, there's my email. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. We're just going to have a couple of minutes now while we get Tuan's presentation loaded up and sorted out. So talk between yourselves for a couple of minutes. Okay, everybody. Can we please welcome Tuan? We'll listen now.
First of all, apologies for the lateness. It was an ordeal, which you should really ask me about in the break. So in this paper, I'm going to be drawing on my experiences at the National Archives of Australia, working with the audiovisual collection. First, I will give an overview of the history of the collection and outline three areas where there is LGBTIQ content. This serves as an introduction to a preliminary collection search I did at the archives, and leads me to some broader reflections on the importance of metadata and seizing any opportunities for queer inclusion from the inside of cultural institutions. So a bit of context. Australia thinks of itself as a young country. Indeed, before the 1st of January 1901, there was no national government, with all the individual states and territories seeing to their own affairs. After Federation, however, a little over a century ago, the records of the federal government begin, and so too did the collection of the National Archives of Australia. Government agencies are required to retain and deposit their records, building the collection to its current 378 shelf kilometres spread across its offices in all states and territories. This is to say that if you put a standard archival box on its side, one after the other, the boxes would stretch from Berlin to Prague. This statistic mostly applies to paper records, of course. In my time at the National Archives, I worked exclusively with the audiovisual collection. The material comes from agencies such as the national television broadcaster, the ABC, Radio National, Screen Australia, which is a major funder of Australia's film and television industry, security agencies such as ASIO, and scientific research agencies such as the CSIRO. Although it doesn't really make sense to give the shelf length of the audiovisual collection, 25 kilometres has been suggested. That's all the film cans on their sides, boxes of VHS and audio cassettes, magnetic video and audio reels, gramophone records, LP records, and unusual formats such as wire recordings. I'll be discussing three areas where there is LGBTIQ content at the National Archives. First, among ASIO files, second, among the censorship cuts, and third, as part of publicly broadcasted material. So the Australian Security Intelligence Agency, or ASIO, is Australia's national security agency. Since it was founded shortly after the Second World War, it has developed dossiers on, quote, persons of interest and security risks. In the conservative post-war climate and during the political agitations of the 1960s and 70s, ASIO surveilled communists, anarchists, feminists, anti-war activists, Indigenous activists, journalists, and environmentalists. Of relevance here are the gay rights campaigners who were distinguished enough to have caught the attention of ASIO, including Dennis Altman, who published the highly influential gay liberation book, Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, in 1972, And also Lex Watson, who was a prominent member of the Campaign Against Moral Persecution, or CAMP. The dossiers consisted of published materials produced by the individuals, telephone intercepts, covert photographs, and cine film. Under the Archives Act, these classified documents can be requested after 30 years, though this is gradually reducing to 20. A second area of the audiovisual collection where there is LGBTIQ content is the censorship cuts. They are called cuts, as the Australian Classification Board would literally cut out strips of film from the reels. The uncensored films would be refused classification and banned from domestic screening. Looking over the censorship cuts, I have identified 16 of relevance to queer researchers released between the years 1963 and 1981. Some of these are low-budget sexploitation films, clearly for the titillation of male audiences. Others, however, are well-known feature films, including Reflections in a Golden Eye, released in 1967, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando, the latter playing the role of a sexually confused army officer who, when his wife begins to stray, turns to a young male soldier. Ironically, and not surprisingly, censored material garners the intense fascination of researchers and the public, something that the National Archives now capitalizes upon. Selections of the 15,000 works of censored literature between the years 1920s and 1970s were featured in the exhibition Banned in 2013. And last year, the researcher Sari Braithwaite released a documentary with selections of censorship cuts from the archives collection. Finally, we'd expect there to be LGBTIQ content among the hundreds and thousands of publicly broadcasted items in the collection. After all, the national television and radio organisations, the ABC and Radio National, are required to transfer masters of their programs to the archives, resulting in the enormous collection of film reels, one-inch video reels, quarter-inch audio reels, DAT tapes, Betacam, etc. Basically, every audiovisual format from the last century. The collection is managed through the database called MediaFlex, which you see above, and its data model is pretty complex. Here we see its four core layers: title, version, media item, and carrier, which separates out the content dimensions of the items from the physical media which could hold them. This makes sense to an audiovisual archivist, but is slightly incomprehensible to even other archivists who work with paper-based collections. I dare say that most of the members of the public who search the catalogue don't really understand what they're searching for. Quite reasonably, they expect a Google-like search, and when they receive few results using a search strategy which would have worked on Google, they might conclude that that's all there is. This was also my conclusion after I plugged in a few search terms: gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer, etc. However, the search fields available to the public only search the first two layers, containing titles, the name of the television or radio series, broadcast dates, episode information, and if there was one, the synopsis. Most records, however, do not contain this full suite of information. One item in particular brought home to me the hidden significance of the collection, a tape that was titled Homo Conference that had no other details. Intriguing. It had no date, so I looked at the segment sheet inside the film can. It was broadcast on the 18th of August, 1975. Given that it came from the Victorian studio of the ABC, I concluded that this tape was likely a news recap of the first National Homosexual Conference in Melbourne, held on the 16th and 17th of August, 1975. I excitedly reported my discovery to the Director of Audiovisual Preservation and asked permission to continue doing more research in the area. As the digital archiving project I was working on had stalled due to technical issues, I had some time to devote to this new side project. Having done my doctoral research on LGBTIQ inclusion in Australian museums, I had searched exhaustively for collection surveys that had been done in Australia. To date, there has really only been one survey to systematically search across museum and archive collections there. incidentally conducted by one of the conference organizers, Kate Davison. In 2005, she searched the collection databases of various organizations for items of relevance to queer history. One of the results was that she was able to identify 97 such objects in the museum's Victoria collection. Interestingly, in 2006, she noted that after searching the database of the National Archives of Australia, quote, multiple records were found and documented. However, more research is required to look at the records that cannot be identified by keyword searches. Also worth noting is that only around 10% of the NAA's overall holdings appear in the online database, end quote. It became clear to me that the results I was getting from my initial collection search was just the tip of the iceberg. Revealing more of it required enriching and connecting the metadata. This turns dissociated fragments such as homo conference and a date such as the 18th of August 1977 into a significant recording of queer history. In this case, this was the first of the annual homosexual conferences, which became important forums for political organization and reflection. To start my search, I compiled a list of keywords that I would search for in the databases available to me. These came from my own readings of queer history and, here's a hint, by looking at the indexes of history texts. I came up with keywords which could be grouped into terms of identification used within and outside the community, so that includes slurs, significant events in organizations, cultural works, and people associated with the queer community, so artists, politicians, activists, and academics, including those who have hated us through time. Importantly, this was a snowballing list, so as I came across new keywords through the results, they would be added to the list and used to search the databases again. After finding an item, I would add the GLBT genre tag available within MediaFlex and import production notes and synopses. These searches were done in the databases not available to the public, including MediaFlex, which manages the archive's audiovisual collection, the TV and radio databases of the ABC, the production databases of Screen Australia, and consignment and segment sheets that accompany these items as they come to the archives. The results were fairly surprising. Before I started my little side project, there were less than 10 items with the LGBT tag, and now there are over 700, with over 400 of these publicly accessible. Before I give a snapshot of some of the items I found, I have to give a disclaimer. Legally, I can only mention titles that are viewable by members of the public, which excludes government records produced after 1997. Also, having already discussed the censorship cuts in ASIO files, the remainder of the relevant LGBTIQ content mainly comes from public broadcast agencies. Having said that, there are items which fall into other categories. These include AV items that were not broadcasted, such as the proceedings of the High Court, Croom versus State of Tasmania is an example. There is also AV material among the personal papers sent to the archives, including those of Michael Kirby, former High Court Justice. Another gem I found among the personal papers of Paul Keating, a former Prime Minister, was a recording from a talkback radio show, 2UE, where the host, a notorious shock jock, calls Keating's members of staff fags for attending taxpayer-funded yoga classes. The earliest recording I found comes from a 1958 episode of the radio comedy show The Idiot Weekly. It refers to one of the centres of nightlife in Sydney, King's Cross, and its sordid reputation, perhaps a place you might find a sex worker or drag performer. One person on the show announces, M for Mary, G for Gordon. The other responds, that's a funny name for a man. The other replies, not in King's Cross. Moving forward in time, the archives has the master tapes of well-known events from the 70s and 80s, like the first same-sex kiss on Australian television in 1972, gay liberation activists protesting outside the ABC about homosexual representations in the media, also from 1972, and much of the mainstream reporting in the aftermath of the Mardi Gras, the first Mardi Gras in 1978, where 53 people were arrested. The public broadcast of the ABC produced a number of series that kept gay and lesbian struggles in the public consciousness. The series Checkerboard reflected the radical social changes that were underway from the 1960s through the lens of ordinary people. In addition, the radio program City Extra produced a number of programs featuring activists like Lex Watson and Jamie Gardner, as well as reactionaries such as the Reverend Fred Nile. And beginning with the current affairs program This Day Tonight in the 1960s and continuing into the 1970s with Monday Conference, the ABC did amazing work through these current affairs programs to promote discussion of gay and lesbian issues. These included several episodes on aversion therapy, episodes featuring activists such as Dennis Altman, Peter Bonsall Boone, and Anne Deveson, an expose of the probable police murder of George Duncan, and transgender performer Carlotta. Finding 700 plus titles in spare moments at the National Archives brought on mixed feelings. I have felt sheer joy in connecting the dots and being able to positively identify a significant moment of queer history. I have felt anger at the same conservative forces at work through time, and I have felt inspired and humbled by the work of gay, lesbian, and queer activists and the changes they have brought about. But many titles leave me with another feeling, one of puzzlement or longing, of wanting to know more even if, after using all the resources at my disposal, they remain silent. There is no less than 4 reels of film with the title Anti-Homosexuality, all broadcast on different dates in the early 1980s, where nothing else is known about them. As with other titles including Gay Protest, Gay Report, and Homosexual Blood, which have 3, 2, and 2 stub records respectively. What is this footage about? Well, it's impossible to say without watching or listening to them, something that is unfortunately not within the remit of an AV archivist. I cannot simply put the reel in a projector or the tapes in a player. They are precious, as they may be the only recording, and therefore the policy is to digitize them before playing them, an expensive and labor-intensive exercise that must be done in response to public requests or because of the threat of imminent loss. There's a catch-22, though. How would you know if something is worthy of digitization if you haven't digitized it to find out? Watching or listening to the items without existing access copies is an expensive exercise. $90 per audio item, $105 per video item, and $195 per film item. That's a lot to pay if you're not sure about what's on it. My project to tag LGBTIQ items in the audiovisual collection at the archives has reinforced to me the importance of metadata. In this case, the program information, synopses, and dates that turn just another government record into something that is precious to queer history. Unfortunately, no one cares about this history as much as we do. So it also reminded me of the responsibility I feel of doing everything I can from the inside of museums and archives I find myself working in to preserve, enrich, and widen the visibility of this material. Regrettably, I am limited in what I can share by the open access period set by the government, but I have created an online spreadsheet of the titles that can currently be accessed. Hopefully, by doing research on these titles, from the well-known to the mysterious, we can deeply link ourselves into the records of the National Archives of Australia. Queerness is already in the archive, even a generally pale, male, and stale government one, if only we look close enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Tuan. Okay, I'm going to give us all 5 minutes to chat and discuss your questions, and then we'll come back together as a panel, and you can ask questions to everybody. We've got about half an hour, so we've got a bit of time left. Okay, everybody. Can everybody hear from this mic? Great. So there's going to be a roaming mic that will be brought to you. So if anybody has a question, do you want to stick your hand up? And our lovely helper here will bring you a mic. So here to start with.
Thank you for three great presentations. I learned a lot. My question is about the Homosaurus. So I'm really fascinated by what you're doing. I'm really interested in the global history of concepts, especially like translation theory and how it fits with conceptual history. And you're sitting on a gold mine there. It's really, really exciting. So I was wondering in those three articles that you're planning for next year, if there's anything about conceptual history and about how all those terms that you're gathering together can also be like factors and indicators of change, and if you were planning to do anything with this.
Yeah, one of the articles that the group is planning to write is going to be dealing with the more theoretical aspects of our work, which we weren't presenting today. This was more kind of the story of what we did, which we're going to write one article about. But another article is going to be more about the theory that went behind it and, you know, the concepts. And sort of like what we hope to accomplish with that. And then a third article is going to deal more with the linked data vocabulary aspects of it.
Thank you. Yeah, go for it.
It was a bit linked with that. I come from France, and we talk a lot about translating or creating a Homosaurus too. And so there's a project already going on about a translation in French, I think, and I don't know where it's at. But my question is, from the French perspective, when we see the Homosaurus, sometimes there are some reservations. When we see that it's being hosted by the College of Holy Cross, and I was just wondering how that worked, because sometimes there are suspicions because we all know the position of church on certain aspects. So I was wondering about that.
Can I just check before we carry on? Did everybody hear that? Yeah, great.
Okay, so the reason why it's hosted at the College of the Holy Cross, which is in Worcester, Massachusetts, is because that's where the Digital Transgender Archive is located. K.J. Rawson is in charge of that, and he got his university to host it. And they are a Catholic university, but they're Jesuit, which tends to be more progressive. I actually happen to work at another Jesuit university in Los Angeles, and they've always been very supportive of my queer work as well. But I would think that, you know, in the future, it doesn't necessarily have to be hosted at the College of Holy Cross. It may be hosted somewhere else, especially if things change with who's involved.
Thank you. Yep.
All the questions are here. thank you all. It was very, very fascinating. And I also learned a lot. And I, too, have a question for the Homosaurus. I come from Haifa, Israel, Palestine. And through your throughout your talk, I was thinking about, like, I think also you mentioned about the relationship between English and other languages, and how does it work with the thesaurus. For example, if I understand correctly, the Homosaurus wants to kind of connect different concepts and terms that are similar or can be can be in one hierarchy under a broader term. But then you sometimes end up flattening maybe like the cultural histories of a certain place. For example, I think of like transgender history in Israel, where people didn't always were called trans or transgender. We used different terms, scandalistit, coccinellit, different things. And in our work, we try and think, okay, how does it fit with like more global histories, and where did their sexual or gender concepts come from, and how this juxtaposition of different concepts from different places in the world created these histories and terms. And I wondered how does it play within this thesaurus, and how do you make place for these things, but still are able to kind of connect them like with this complexity. I hope I was clear.
Thank you. That's a great question. Can I ask to open that one up to the panel? Because I think that's going to have implications also on your work and on your work potentially in Australia with looking at terminology from Indigenous groups as well.
Well, we try to be international as possible, to be as international as possible. And a thesaurus is never finished, so terms can be added and concepts from other countries can be added. On the website, it's possible, of the Homosaurus, it's possible to make suggestions, and we take it into our editorial board, and we'll try to put it into the existing Homosaurus.
But then you kind of interlink between the existing terms and the new terms, and then how will you do it?
Well, that's what the editorial board are doing, it to put those terms in the right place.
Yeah, that's actually what a lot of our work over the last 3 years has been, in that kind of area of like fitting the terms into the hierarchies. And they've gone through many revisions that way. Sometimes we would put terms in one place and then change our minds and decide they should be somewhere else. And I think that they will continue to change over time, especially as we get a deeper understanding of what the terms mean, because sometimes a term comes to us or is in the thesaurus that we're not quite sure what it means, and we try to do research and find out what exactly is it, and then where is its right place, and that's another reason why we hope to get other people involved in the future that may know more about these things, and to get more terms from other languages and to even get it translated into other languages. Right now it's in English. The original version is in Dutch and English, and the abridged Homosaurus is going to be translated into Dutch as well.
Does anybody else want to help?
Thank you. I can only speak about my own experience on this one, but it is a constant challenge, an interesting challenge. I always include a section in introductions about terms which is dated before a book even comes out. Notes are our friends, because what the language, it's not just different nations, it's class, social class also, and region. And so let me give you two quick examples. In the chapter I co-authored with Miriam, one of the people I interviewed used a term that the literal translation into English, and this person was speaking to me in English, my graduate assistant immediately picked out and said, I find this term offensive, you've got to change it. And I said, but this person is Dutch, is perfectly comfortable using it, and this is the term this person used, and it's an interview. So we left it. The other example is in your flyer, the term cisgender. One of the contributors objected to that, and it is a term that's debated a great deal. We used it largely because we had so little space. It was a very crass reason for our decision. Yet, if I had a dollar or a euro for every time I've heard that term here, there's obviously still a lot of people who think that term is great. So you're always... I think this is one of the front areas of the field. You're always thinking about it, because language shapes our knowledge, and our knowledge shapes language.
So obviously Indigenous terms did make their way into the keywords I was searching for. sister girl and brother boy come to mind. But I'm not sure whether anything actually turned up. Part of that is, I guess, these terms weren't used until quite sort of mainstream usage until quite recently, and the government agencies are still have that material that I haven't sent it to the archives. I so wanted to find things that I was plugging in, like historical terms, sapphic, something like that, and I so wanted things to come up, but they didn't. I found that most of the, I actually did like a numerical thing of how many results per term, and the ones that came up the most were gay and homosexual, which is why I thought it was very important to sort of like pass that out and get as much surrounding material as possible to draw in more key terms that I could search for.
Thank you. Thank you all. Does anybody over this side have a question? I'm aware we've been...
Okay. Hi. I was interested, I guess, in thinking about your talk, Tuan, and your reference to the people who most care about material is ourselves. I guess particularly in institutional settings where projects like yours requires senior management buy-in often or support in some context, that a lot of work is not core business, and doing that work happens either on the side when you slip it in and you're changing records, or but getting that level of support from executive is really helpful. I guess I would just want to, if anyone could reflect on their experience, if they have it, working in those institutions around mainstream institutions, about that kind of support or not.
Yeah, so I'm not even sure I would call it a project. It was kind of just something I did in my spare time. and I mean, this is like a major theme of the conference, is like, how do we sustain inclusion beyond individual initiative? And in my case, it was completely individual initiative. Like, I did get permission from the director to do it. It was kind of this vague, yeah, you know, just do your work and in your spare time, yeah, just continue doing that, and that's what I did. And but that was a small level of commitment. That was like, I was salaried and I was using federal money in order to do this, and I wanted to expand further. I wanted the archives to sort of reach out to relevant organizations, ALGA, for instance, or LGBT historians. But when I mooted that, it was, this particular person didn't seem very interested. But I was glad for that level of permission, at least. Was it?
Thank you. Does anybody else want to respond to that? About how your sort of executive was supportive of the work you've been doing in your institutions? The executive of your institutions were supportive of what you've been doing, and how you found that?
Yeah, actually, because I work in a library at a private university in Los Angeles, and the dean of my library has been quite supportive of my work, like with the Homosaurus and my other queer work, like being a director at large and the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Roundtable of ALA. I was able to do like some of my work on the Homosaurus, like during work time. But at the same time, you know, she was also, you know, at one point agitating that I should be done with it by now, that, you know, why was it taking so long? And so I expressed that to the rest of the board, that, you know, are we going to be coming to some kind of conclusion soon? And I think actually that probably helped us to kind of move it along a little bit. But we're all volunteers generally, you know, working on this, so that's why it can, you know, a project like this can take 3 or more years to complete.
I might just add that an alternative title to my paper was Begged, Borrowed, and Stolen, because it somewhat feels like that. I can't believe that I'd spent that much time looking for those things. I think it's kind of inclusion by stealth, and I'm now working at a museum, and I'm doing the same thing. It keeps me going.
I've been fortunate to have institutional support because I spent most of my career in a gender studies program. So they sort of expect me to cause some trouble. I should say, however, that this may be one of those places where academia makes a difference too, because if you bring out the books, they're happy.
Thank you. I'll just add my experience of this as well is that I started off doing a kind of volunteer flagging of things on our database, and that's then escalated. And as a result of there being some positive result from that volunteering, I've then had management buy-in for much bigger projects. So I think sometimes some of that sort of stealth stealing a bit of time from your other projects can lead to a lot more. Has anybody got any other questions?
I do want to say that this is partly how the field has changed, because I remember in 92 or 93 when I first became head of a gender studies program, and it had always been a volunteer post at my university. And finally, when I was asked to do it, I said, I'll do it, but I need some compensation and or release time from other responsibilities. And the university was withholding, and I said, well, it would be very unfortunate if a perception were to arise that yet again women were expected to do unwaged labor. And I think that veiled threat carried the day. But I think things have changed substantially.
Thank you. Any other questions from anybody? Go for it.
Thank you. Thank you for your talks. My name is Hannes Hacke. I talked yesterday about the German initiative to translate the Homosaurus that we're working on, or not only also the translation of the Homosaurus, but actually thinking about German thesauri and what are the terminology, even within the German-speaking countries that are different from Austria, Switzerland, and Germany. And so maybe this is for all of you, but thinking about translation actually and the dominance of the English language within the field that queer LGBTIQ arms is in. I'm also researching on exhibition history in Germany, on LGBTIQ exhibition history, and I really see a lack of acknowledgement or in that in the field of museum studies, and that is most often in English. So there's a lack of knowledge about these exhibitions, about the catalogs that were never translated. So there's a huge translation issue and lack of knowledge, transfer of knowledge, and certain kind of exhibition histories are written, genealogies, where I think, well, no, there was other stuff happening in other parts, for example, in Berlin, that doesn't get acknowledged. So that's maybe for the question of publishing also, what gets translated and how could stuff be more translated? Would that help? And the other thing is actually the reference framework. So if the Homosaurus, which is now in English word, I mean, drawing, you know, the framework is an English-speaking framework in a way. Does that affect, and I think this draws on what you were saying, does that affect the way we think about queering memory if that is dominated by that way? So, I think there's great value in what in the work that you're doing, and we draw on this, and I think with the internationalization of LGBTIQ language, of LGBTIQ acronym as an example, I think maybe some of your thoughts on these problems of translation, of a dominance of one global language, and so forth. I mean, yeah.
Thank you. So To summarize, you sort of got two parts to the question. It's really the translation issue of these things, and then also the reference frame at work, and then how that affects everything. Yeah? Great. So, who wants to start?
Well, the translation thing, well, it originally started in Dutch, and homosaurus is a Dutch word also. So it's the same word, so that there wasn't a translation problem. That was not typically English. But I think it's very well if other LGBTQ people in other countries are translating it in their time, in their language, and add also concepts from those language into the homosaurus. And we think the homosaurus, the term homosaurus, is a very strong concept. So we decided to keep that and not make LGBTQ something out of it, but to have a more clear subtitle to make very clear that it should be a very inclusive thesaurus. That answers your question? Okay.
Well, I guess I'll bring it back to some of the National Archives stuff. Australia, if you looked at the map of Indigenous languages in Australia, it's a rainbow of another sort. There are close to 200 Indigenous languages. Mediaflex, it's all English language. There is, there are some small, very small accommodations to Indigenous cultures that are available within the system. One that comes to mind are indicators, which we can add to sensitive records, which means that they're not public. The archives is doing some stuff in the area, but probably not enough.
Well, I think there are two sides of the translation issue for me. One is, as a museum scholar, I often worry about what I'm missing when I'm reading the English translation of labels. That really worries me because I could be missing all kinds of nuances. On the other hand, I see editing as a continuation of my gender activism. And by that I mean, if I'm working with people for whom English is not their first language, I really want to help them in every way bring their work out in a way that's the best possible reflection of what they originally intended. And so I will send an edited text, I've driven some people in this room nuts, back and forth maybe 5 and 6 times as we keep working it, playing with the words and changing it, and trying to get the best possible expression of what they intended in a way that will also make clear to English-speaking audiences how important what they have to say is. So to me, that's part of my activism, to help level that playing field. And I have ticked off some people with my intensive editing and going back and forth. They just want to be in print, period. And so I realize there's downsides to it. But at the same time, I think there have been a lot of people who have been happy that we've had this collaboration. At least I hope so.
Brilliant. Thank you. I'm afraid we're out of time, so if you've got burning questions, please do come and ask the panel afterwards. Thank you so much. I think that's a great point to end on. I hope you've enjoyed the session, everybody.